This is Geek Speak for Saturday, April 4th, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Geek Lyle Troxell, with me in Ben's apartment in Los Gatos, California, the soul of Silicon Valley. We have Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek.
Lyle, this is a duplex.
Excuse me. You know, you're going to say why this is the soul of Silicon Valley?
Because of the silicon?
No, because Woz lives in Los Gatos.
Oh, that's true.
And he is the soul of
Steve
geekdom.
Wozniak.
Sure.
Okay. One of the two Steves of Apple. Well,
if you don't know who Woz is, stop listening. But actually, if you don't know who Woz, if you want to learn more about him, you can listen in on one of our shows. We interviewed Woz, and it was fantastic having him on the show. But anyway, we also have in the room, in the studio, Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, programmer, a virtual lighting engineer, and all-around great geek. Hi.
Hey, thanks. Hi.
Welcome back. How long has it been since you've been on?
Oh, goodness. I can't keep track.
6 months?
6 months.
All right.
Virtual lighting engineer mean?
Listen to earlier shows.
Virtually light.
You virtually light?
Lighting in the computer, lighting in a virtual environment, lighting in something that does not physically exist.
So like Pixar-y stuff and like virtual game,
In fact, in Monsters, Inc., when you're in the giant room where the doors get planted and people open, the monsters open up.
I love that scene.
Brian lit that scene.
No, really?
Yeah.
Well, and like all movie making, there's another 100 people involved as well. Okay. But yes, right. Yes, I was one of the hands in that.
Okay, virtual lighter. You know, it's funny, another good friend of mine is David, and David is a professor of lighting.
And, David Cuthbert.
Yes. And David and Brian can talk about lighting. But of course, Brian gets to light with shadow. He can actually, cast shadow?
It's one of those things. We sit there and start talking about lighting, and then we realize that about 90% of what we know is actually the making our craft happen with our tools, and it's about 10% of it is just the art of lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway. Shall we move on?
Yeah.
Well, one thing, Brian, you did recently went into an Apple store and have played with the MacBook, and I haven't played with it yet, and I'm jealous. And what do you think? The MacBook, of course, is the very thin, lighter, quieter, all that kind of MacBook, and it also has a new keyboard and things of that nature.
So they've got the new touchpads out. Mm-hmm. They call them Force touchpads, and they have not gotten the new MacBooks in the stores that I've seen.
It was just the touchscreen.
Well,
they've
got them on the new MacBook Pros. So what was really amazing about this is, for those of you who haven't heard about this, it's a trackpad that doesn't actually physically move, but they create the click through these haptic feedback mechanisms.
Little motion motors kind of.
Yeah, but it completely tricks your brain.
Wait, so you're talking about if I click on one of these trackpads, it'll buzz back at me, kind of like my phone does?
No, it's not a buzz. You press down on it and it feels like a click.
But it doesn't move.
What it's actually doing is sending a sound wave through the glass, making it slightly, very imperceptibly, slightly move to the side. But your touch reads it as an actual click up and down. But what's cool about this is in software, they can now control when you feel that click. So you press down a little bit, you feel the click. Press down a little bit harder, you get another click. And you can keep pressing into a deeper click. So
okay, wait. Just be clear. The glass, so a touchpad on these new devices is a glass surface. It has no ability to move up and down. There's no hinge. Like the current trackpads that we all have in front of us, they actually have a hinge. You click on them and they actually move. And there's a click sensation because there's a switch or something that sounds like a switch. And in this one, the thing doesn't move at all. It registers that you have pressure on it by some kind of induction of pressure sensitivity, probably like a little bit like a measuring device in your house if you'd stand on a scale. It doesn't move very much. So there's some kind of movement to determine pressure, right?
I assume it must be the tiniest bit of movement, but it's nothing you can see.
And then after that, this thing injects a sound wave that tricks your neuro system to say, yeah, that clicked.
Exactly. And it completely fools your brain.
You really couldn't feel it. You couldn't tell that. You thought it was clicking.
The only way you can
be
sure that...
You weren't holding an old model?
Yeah, the only way you can be sure is that you turn the machine off and you press it again and nothing happens.
No, great.
That is so weird. So if your machine freezes up, then your trackpad stops clicking.
This could be a problem.
That's like wrong. It's like the universe breaking.
That's
wow, that's cool. So do you like it?
I thought it was incredible. Yes.
Yeah, but would you want to use it?
Yeah, I completely replace whatever trackpad I have right now with that. Now, you get to control how much pressure it takes to feel the click and then how much the click is. I actually turned that all the way up so it feels more like the trackpad I'm used to. But you can change the sensitivity.
And then they're basically allowing for a secondary click, you'd mentioned, and they're calling this a force click?
Well, the force is because it can measure your pressure.
Okay.
But the software can choose when you feel the click, and as you increase the pressure, you can get another click and another click. Or in like in iMovie, they're starting to do this now. As you roll the scroll bar to the end of the scrolling
area, as you use the trackpad to swipe back and forth
right.
on the player,
then it'll click itself, make you feel a click. You didn't press down; you just scrolled it to the left, but you came to the end of the scroll bar, and it'll just give you a little bump, telling you, "Oh, you're at the end."
That makes sense. I mean, that's exactly what the word haptic means, right? Yeah. Is touch feedback, haptic feedback. Yeah.
Very cool.
That's really cool.
I can definitely see some new gestures, new things you're doing. Like you could potentially use this to navigate without sight, partially, to feel some of the texture of the screen, because it could give feedback whenever the mouse position moved over a contrasting area. Pretty cool.
And you know, the other thing is, when you think about the future of interaction, you look at the futuristic movies and everything, and everyone's still interacting with everything on these flat glass surfaces because that's what looks beautiful on the screen and everything. But I mean, we have this entire dimension that we're evolutionarily predisposed to be able to take advantage of, you know, like everything in the real world, quote unquote, that you interact with has a texture, has a shape, has a weight, has, you know, inertia and everything. So I guess seeing haptic feedback make its way into our interactions with technology, I think, is only natural.
I agree completely. Ben?
Have you ever, I'll just ask either of you, have you ever been writing an email and you type something into the to field and you don't really look very closely and it auto-completes someone you don't mean to send the message to and then you press send?
You mean like my friend Jim, who I never call him James, but for some reason he pops up as James and I send him the wrong one?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or I meant to send this to the other Alex, right?
So this happens a lot at work because you're sending to someone, you've met them in the meeting. His name's, you know, Brian, for example. You type in Brian and he goes to somebody.
There he is.
Brian
at the company. Yeah. But there are a lot of people named Brian who work at your company. So this actually happened. This happened to world leaders. So they were sending an email that involved passport numbers and dates of birth and other personal information on the heads of states that were attending this G20 summit in Australia. And someone accidentally, one of the immigration officers that was sending this information around, accidentally emailed it to, not the person they meant to one of the organizers of January's Asian Cup football tournament. And so this person got an email with a whole bunch of passport numbers and dates of birth of world leaders. And
Oh,
that's horrible.
Why are they emailing this information?
I was
information?
About to say.
This
well, okay. I mean, so that's the first issue, right?
Yes, of course.
That's the first issue. I think that's... So using email to send sensitive data is just... As a concept, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Absolutely.
You're not setting yourself up for success. If you use something that's secure, that has protections against things like this happening, you're setting yourself up for success. And you fall into the pit of success instead of the pit of failure, right?
The pit of success.
I did not coin...
Can you say pedestal of success, maybe?
The pit of success. I did not coin that term, but I love it. So, yeah, that was President Obama and Vladimir Putin.
How would you do this? If you wanted to send off a whole bunch of passports and stuff, how would you send it to somebody?
I don't know. I mean, there are just so many different ways to send secure information.
Well, like, what would you do?
I mean, you're putting me on the spot here.
I know I am. Brian, got any ideas?
I mean, there are secure messaging mediums. Like, for example, WhatsApp uses some very secure messaging protocols.
But, of course, the other person has to be set up for that. They have to have an account. You have to know it.
A little trickier.
So you can make a disk image that's password protected.
Yeah, that's one. If you're both on an operating system that has the same disk image types.
Yeah, like you could send it in some kind of...
Encrypted Word document.
You could.
Password protected.
That would work.
I just did this last weekend when I had to share my tax information with an accountant.
What'd you do?
I put it on my server, and I gave it a file name. Out
that was
of my
long
one
random.
Password, random password name. That was the file name,
and
I
then
sent
you emailed
him that
it
URL. And then I was able to watch the logs and see if anybody else downloaded it.
Yeah, sure you did.
Interesting.
So what about Google Doc? What about Google Doc?
So that's security by obfuscation.
Yes,
that's not actually being secured, except for the fact that no one knows where to look.
So if it's large enough obfuscation, it's pretty secure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying it's insecure. I'm just saying.
So what about a Google Doc?
A Google Doc would work, especially if you have two-factor authentication.
Assuming you trust Google.
And
then you can share in a Google Doc with a Gmail account relatively safely. It doesn't get sent through open email.
Yeah.
It's only available through SSL. So that's relatively safe.
Yeah. I mean, to do this, you have to trust a company.
Yeah.
You pretty much have to trust a company unless you write it down on a piece of paper and you walk it over.
How about pretty good privacy?
Pretty good privacy. Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Or GNU Privacy Guard.
Yeah. So there are open source tools that do this.
That makes sense, and everybody's listening and understands completely what we're talking about, right? I think a Google Doc makes sense. Like any kind of app that you both have that maybe supports this, like password protection in a Word document, would make sense. Well, anyway, let's move on.
One other way. I mean, if you have to use email, just be really, really sure that you're sending it to the person you think you're sending it to.
That sounds good.
Double check everything.
And then hope that the email protocol doesn't get listened into, which is very easy to do. Okay,
Ben, it's important stuff.
We are recording in your house again. I mentioned that because I would like feedback from listeners. How does the audio quality sound? We've changed from KOSP Studios into Los Gatos apartment, or excuse me, duplex.
Duplex, yes.
And of course, there's more reverb in this room. There's less CDs on the walls. But in general, I think the sound quality is pretty good. I'd love to hear from you. If you find it frustrating, you like it, whatever, that sounds good. Please do let us know.
I do have a record player, though.
Oh, that's good.
Just like USB.
Yeah. And Ben, last week when we talked, I just visited your restroom and I saw your toilet and how you're like filling from a tank.
So we water conservation.
From that, from last week. And that is...
Oh, we got... Paul. Someone wrote in?
Oh, yeah. Paul joined us on Facebook and said, "Hey, just listen to the March 28th show. Good show, as always. But as an East Coaster, it's hard to grok or understand fully what the West Coast is going through with your drought.
Uh-huh.
Wish we could deliver some of the water, snow, torrential rains we have been getting to the West. Okay, for Ben's toilet taking an hour to fill, it sounds like you need to change the valve and float. Maybe Ben's tank valve is just bad, worn out. Maybe a new valve would be faster. A tank lever type float may allow a larger and faster valve." Now, I already responded to him and I said, you know, Ben rents this apartment, duplex, and therefore ripping apart the toilet's a bad idea. In fact, you didn't do that, right?
No,
you didn't modify the toilet in any way except for to...
I just rested some things on top of the toilet tank. Right.
And in fact, you went and bought some kind of float system from a garden store.
Yeah, a little ball valve thing that has a little float and it comes off of a garden hose, which comes out of the big basin. I don't know. It's very hackneyed together.
Yeah.
But... I'm actually thinking about doing a lot more research because also, as the weeks have gone on since I implemented this last iteration of the system, it's started filling slower and slower and slower, probably because there's a little bit of dirt or dust or something in the water that is clogging the valve.
The other thing to note, of course, is that your system right now allows you to remove a pencil and then fill from the normal water system. So let's say you run out of water in your shower waste water tank that you put above.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you want to see a photo of this from last week's show, the 28th of March, you can take a look at what it
looks
like.
You know, I never thought that my water conservation toilet setup would get this much attention.
But
I love
it. But then you invited geeks to your house to record audio.
That's true. And
there you go. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me is Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. And we'll be right back. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me is Ben and Brian. And if you want to participate in Geeks, Geekspeak in general, I just mentioned on a Facebook page, we had some feedback, and you're welcome to also, and that's KOSP Geeks on Facebook. And you can also join us on Twitter at KOSP Geeks. You're welcome to send us notes and ask us questions and all of those wonderful things. All right, let's jump back into the news if we can. I think it's Brian's turn, but I've lost track of where I am. Ah, yeah, go ahead.
So, Ben, you're an audio engineer, right?
I have done that before, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Audio is a pretty powerful thing, you think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could have put out a fire.
Oh, I don't know.
So
I'm going to guess yes.
Right. What should I say, yes or no?
I think that's pretty amazing. So some researchers at George Mason University have put together a little test, and they have had this thought that maybe a subwoofer could extinguish a fire. And they tried many experiments, and they started with music, and it turns out music is bad.
It's probably not very good.
No. The problem is it's not consistent enough.
You probably also need low frequencies rather than high frequencies.
They did try high frequency.
Doesn't the fire just dance?
Well, it does if you... So they also tried the high frequencies, and that just made it dance as well. It just kind of jittered around. But there is a sweet spot of 30 to 60 hertz that they were able to use to snuff out a fire. It was able to vibrate the air in such a way that the oxygen could not get back into the flame to continue the burning.
Huh. What kind of distance did they have to have from the subwoofer to the flame? You know, centimeters? Feet?
Well, it's probably not too far, right?
Yeah, probably not too far.
The initial test was on a very small scale. They used aerosol of alcohol, uh-huh. and they were able to snuff out a several inch flame with that. But now they're putting it into a handheld mobile device, and they're going to scale it up so that we can have a fire extinguisher that just pumps out sound.
Awesome!
Wow. So rather than blowing air at the flame, this is vibrating the air that the flame is in.
Yeah. The principle is the oxygen can't get back into further ignite the flame if it can't move, if it's trapped in a wave, kind of like an eddy inside of a wave when you're stuck out body surfing. Mm-hmm.
Now, thing I actually did see this video, which is, it's pretty cool. One thing that I wonder about though is whether this would be good for all kinds of fires, right? So like if you have a fire from alcohol versus a grease fire or something, you know, like they behave very differently.
Yeah, if it's getting its own oxygen from its own source, this wouldn't affect it most likely because you'd be moving all the source at the same time.
Yeah, chemical fire is not going to...
Well, yeah, I mean, if you separate it, of course, it would work, but I would assume you just move all the chemicals at the same time, so...
Yeah. I don't know. That's pretty cool, though. You know, so not good as a house fire extinguisher yet.
I don't know. I mean, it could be at some point. I mean, the thing is, a fire extinguisher, when you normally use it, is really messy. So there's some trepidation of using it, even though you might want to use it. So if you've got a fire that's being fed by oxygen and you want to stop it, this you could try it anytime you want.
If you have out of control candles.
Oh, yeah. No, there's some serious...
if this could be scaled up.
Yeah, the scalability is what I'm wondering about.
If this could be scaled up, you think of a fire, the aftermath of a fire, half the damage seems to be caused by what you used to put it out.
Yeah. Speaking of which, drove by on last weekend, and Boulder Creek and one of our beloved spots has burned, and it's very sad, the Boulder Creek Brewery. And yeah, the first thing I noticed was actually the mess of the fire putting out, but the building was completely lost, which is still kind of sad.
Yeah.
And on that note... Sorry. Let's talk about something kind of cool about Amazon. Actually kind of creepy about Amazon. Amazon has a...
Wait, something's creepy about Amazon?
No, they have a non-disclosure agreement. They've been having all of their part-time staff sign and agree to.
Okay, so they say you can't
do blah, blah, blah. So like you've worked at a company before. Like right now you work at Audacity. You probably
freelanced
have a thing
for 7 years, so you're constantly signing NDAs is what they're abbreviated to.
I don't know about Netflix. I might have an NDA against me on like going to a video, competing video service, but probably not because it's really hard to get engineers in Silicon Valley. So I probably don't have I have a non-disclosure agreement, but not a non-compete agreement. And that's the question here is that they are having all of their part-time staff sign this document that said for the next 18 months after working for Amazon, you will not compete with us.
This is for full-time workers?
No, this is just part-time workers, people that like stuff boxes.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Now listen to the engage. You will not engage or support the development, manufacturing, marketing, or sale of any product or service that competes or as is intended to compete with any product or service sold, offered, or otherwise provided by Amazon.
Wait, Lyle, Amazon is
does
in
everything.
It's there in every single space.
Right.
They deliver boxes to people's houses.
You would not be able to work anymore if they didn't compete with Amazon. How would you do it?
They have a cloud server. Netflix runs on Amazon Web Services.
Sure. Everything.
Right? It's insane. So
I guess you could probably start up a company to put out candle fires. So there's that. Right.
Amazon probably sells that.
In any case, the staff has already said the clause has been applied to hourly associates and we're removing it. It wasn't intended for hourly services. It was just a standard contract it was signing for everybody. And so they saw that, got embarrassed. The spokeswoman mentioned to The Guardian, we're pulling that off. In fact, effective immediately, the staff that are part-time are not applicable to that contract.
So somebody actually looked at the documents they signed?
I guess so.
Well, that's rare. Also, non-compete is in certain states. It's really, really hard to get sued for competing, right? Like in California, I know specifically, having a non-compete agreement that you've signed in California is almost worthless.
And, they're really designed for people that have trade secrets and are really at the higher echelon of the company, like the white collar kind of employee, right? That knows a lot about how the business functions, goes to another company, and you really want to make a cooling off period so the insider secrets do not get acted upon. Yeah. That's really what it's for.
But if you're making a low hourly wage and you happen to notice that in your contract, I imagine that would scare you. You know, do I really want to risk Amazon suing me?
Working for FedEx or something? Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben, you haven't given us any space news lately.
Yes. Ah, yes, and I do have one. So this is kind of a fun story. There are a bunch of different pieces to this, and I want to try and talk about all of them. So this is NASA officials talking about this specific asteroid mission that they're planning on launching or hoping to launch. And it would launch somewhere around 2020, around that time frame. So one of the things it would do, it's called the Asteroid Redirect Mission. And what most people are talking about is the part of the mission where they land on an asteroid, they pick up a rock, like a 4-meter-ish sized boulder.
That's a big boulder, but go on.
It's a big boulder, right? And they lift off of the asteroid with the boulder from mm-hmm. the asteroid.
Sure.
And they put it in orbit around the moon.
Around our moon. Okay.
Now, just to have fun with English here, our moon is a natural satellite of Earth.
Yes.
If we put something in orbit around the moon, that is a natural satellite-ish because it's a rock, but it's artificially put there. So we're artificially putting a natural satellite around our natural satellite.
I don't think that if you even if it's a rock, if you put it in orbit, I don't think that's a natural. I think that the orbit itself is natural or not the object.
All right. Well, but regardless, case, it is it's an fun. Artificial satellite.
Yes.
Around
a natural satellite.
A natural satellite. Yeah. That's kind of
now,
crazy.
Wouldn't you also alter the asteroid's trajectory if you're removing a large mass like that?
Well, ever so slightly. But actually, this is another part of the mission, is while they're at this asteroid, they're going to try...
And they are is a robot, right?
NASA's robot. Not
human
humans.
Craft. Yeah, go on.
No. So, by the way, the taking the rock off of the asteroid and putting that in orbit around our moon is kind of a compromise from one of the original ideas, which is taking an asteroid, the entire asteroid, wow. and putting it in lunar orbit, which is going to be like $100 million more
right.
expensive
right.
and just really, really, really hard.
So what's the second thing they're planning on doing?
The second thing they're going to try and do is they're going to try and test out the idea of gravitational tractor beams.
Yes.
So if you watch
Scott
Star Trek,
so happy.
If you watch Star Trek, like I do quite frequently, there's this idea of a tractor beam where you engage this tractor beam and then you can move objects with this kind of, I don't know,
like a tractor
weird,
beam,
fuzzy, bluish beam that can pull objects or push objects or move them left or right.
So I never understood why the tractor wasn't yellow. The tractor beam was yellow because most tractors are yellow.
Because blue is prettier.
Yeah, it's also more sci-fi.
Yes, that's true.
Well, how are they doing this? Gravity?
So this is not the same as the Star Trek tractor beam. That's why I bring up tractor beam, because that's where the term, as far as I know, came from, is this idea of moving something with some kind of a beam thing. So the way this actually works is you take... all right, so let's do a metaphor. Let's say that you have a ballerina and you have a sumo wrestler, and they're both ice skating, and they're holding arms and they're spinning around each other, right? The sumo wrestler and the ballerina are spinning around each other. It's not that the ballerina is going around the sumo wrestler. They're actually orbiting each other, right?
Just that the big mass doesn't move as much.
Exactly.
Small mass.
Okay. Absolutely. Same thing happens with the Earth and the moon. Same mm-hmm. thing happens with the planets and the sun. Even the teeniest little things are exerting a gravitational pull on the large things. It's
fact,
just a very small thing.
In fact, the tides are the side effect of the wobbly kind of effect of the two bodies.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually also one of the ways that we detect exoplanets.
That's true.
Planets that are really, really far away is by looking at the Doppler shift of the wobble. But I digress. The way gravitational tractoring works is you park some kind of a mass just off to the right or left or something of an asteroid, and then they attract each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the asteroid kind of moves a little bit, and your thing, your little spaceship moves a lot more.
So you
but
have
if
a propulsion
you use,
system on your small craft. You
yeah.
get close enough to be attracted, then you pull away. The thing that's cool about that...
Yeah, exactly. That's the idea, is you don't just put yourself next to and let yourself be attracted and crash
and
into
land.
The surface again.
Right.
You actually park yourself using your thrusters.
Yeah, cool.
So, very slowly, your little mass can change the trajectory of a very large mass.
Right.
So, if there's an asteroid hurtling towards Earth, what do? We do not do Armageddon style. We do not blow it up, because, as Neil deGrasse Tyson says, people here in America are really good at blowing things up, but we're not very good at thinking about where the pieces go after you do.
That's right.
So, yeah.
So, if you have the big problem of an asteroid coming at you and you blow it up, now you have a lot of little problems.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Non-trivial problems.
fast follow-up, lightning follow-up. Tractor Beam was coined in 1931 by E.E. Smith. By E.E. Smith in his novel Space Hounds of IPC, and it first came showed up earlier as a tractor beam, like something that attracts.
Oh,
cool! And then it was abbreviated in tractor beam in his novel.
Hey, there it is. And then one other thing that they're going to try is solar electric propulsion. There are solar electric propulsion system which converts sunlight to electrical power using solar arrays, and then uses that power to propel charged atoms. Ions to move a spacecraft, and it's not nearly as powerful as a rocket, like a traditional rocket, but it's something that you can, you don't have to carry around a bunch of fuel to use it. You can actually use sunlight to do it.
You know, Ben, in radio we like to do transitions between two different bits, right?
That's
one of the jobs as the host.
Segues.
Yeah, segue. So when we were coming out of the Amazon story, I wanted to segue into your story. So I looked in the Google Doc and it says your story that you just covered is giving the moon a moon. And I was thinking of Mooning, which of course is a great song from Greece. And it's about bearing your tush to somebody, right? Bare-bottomed mooning. It's a slang for showing some of your... So I thought that was what the story is about. And I'm really glad I didn't give a segue of that name because it just showed my ignorance to your story. Okay, Brian, what is Slack?
Okay, so Slack is a tool for groups to collaborate and communicate. And so there's a story. They're in the news this week. They're a really young company, but they exploded really quick.
They did.
Yeah, like everyone's using them to communicate in their organization, right?
Have you used Slack?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah, we use it at Netflix.
Yeah, Udacity uses Slack. Oh, they use it at Netflix.
Yeah.
Google
uses it. Well, kind of a side thing. No, we don't use it. I mean, not everybody uses it.
It's not your primary thing.
Yeah. So Slack is like a multi-chat environment thing. And so it's like, kind of, yeah, it's...
So I can private message you. Right. I can private message you, Brian. I can also create a room and we all can join and work on a project.
It's very much like IRC, which has always been a more geeky way of communicating. One of the things you can do in Slack and also in IRC is you can mention somebody kind of like you would a Twitter handle and they get pinged. So an easy way to say, you know, if Ben and I are chatting and we want to have Brian join in, we just say, at Brian, what do you think about this? And all of a sudden he's included in the conversation and alerted that we're having a conversation that he should be included in.
Yeah.
Really cool collaborative communication.
So tool. You guys really like this tool?
I don't know. I mean, it's, yeah.
Well,
I really like it.
No good deed goes unpunished in the internet.
That's true.
Oh, something happened.
We relied upon it, didn't we? Oh, no. Is it going away? Is it closing?
So we talk about stories all the time, and these are in the news every week of some company getting hacked. And this is not just a story about another company getting hacked. The reason why we're talking about it is the way Slack responded. So somebody did hack into their system, and they did have access to the user database, including names and passwords. And
salted hash, though.
A number of identifying pieces of information. But yes, as you say, Ben, it was completely protected in the sense that they're encrypted, and encrypted using SALT, which means they're not easily going to be looked up on a table and broken into. So that information did get out into the hacker community. But what Slack did was immediately turned around and notified everyone and also finished a project to have two-factor authentication turned on and released that immediately as well.
Now, I think the big flaw that they did, of course, is that the email addresses were opened. Right, so the email addresses the hackers did get access to. And that means that they know all the email addresses. Now, it's not a big deal because email addresses are relatively public, but I personally don't like my email address shared publicly because of spam. You know, it just is not such a great thing.
Yeah.
But also, you know, if the hackers know that I use Slack with my email address, they can send me a phishing scheme and I'm more likely to respond to it because they're using the right email address. And probably my phishing, name as well.
And a phishing scheme would be them sending you an email that looks like it came from Slack saying, hey, Lyle, and I'm sending this to your correct email address.
Right.
Hey,
you
Lyle,
know my name. Yeah.
Click here and reset your password. We just got hacked, or I don't know, something like that.
Yeah.
And then you click on it and you type in your credentials.
And if I take the bait, hence phishing, I get hooked.
Although it's phishing with a PH, but you know, the metaphor
that's
works.
That's where it comes from. So, so that is a shame that the email addresses got escaped. And the two-factor authentication, of course, is great because no one can, you know, log into your account unless you have a device of yours as well, which really stops that. But the actual break-in was because of their flaw, and it was clearly a bad flaw. And they owned up to it quick, which is nice.
Yeah.
I just want to applaud a company for responding well, even though mistakes were made.
Yeah. We're looking at you, Target. And like 700 other companies that do this.
That's true. God, it feels like every 2 weeks we cover, you know, oh, this large, humongous retail outlet got hacked, or this company had, you know, data stolen. It's just kind of a sign of our times, and it'll keep happening.
You know, when we were talking about tides a moment ago, giant movements of water because of the moon, I also thought of tsunamis.
Yes. So Japanese authorities have just recently unveiled plans that they have. Now, these are not final plans. But these are plans that they might actually build a giant 250-mile-long wall to protect the coastline from tsunamis. So the idea is, you know, Japan being right on the water, tsunamis obviously impact it, as we learned 4 years ago when that's what happened. And Japan's northeastern coast
It was devastated.
Yeah, it was devastated. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even in Santa Cruz, where our show is broadcast, some boats were capsized. It was a really big tsunami. So,
well, it tore up the docks there.
It did. Oh, yeah. It was pretty bad. So
what do you do about it?
Yeah, what do you do about it? Well, I mean, one option is build gigantic walls all the way along your coast.
That sounds crazy.
It sounds crazy, and it might be crazy. So, I mean, different people obviously have different thoughts on this, right? Yeah. Some people are saying that's a bad idea. We should just deal with the fact that this happens and not put towns and houses right on the coast.
Or have really good early warning systems, have really good evacuation systems, understand absolutely. That buildings are kind of sacrificial, or build them such that you can potentially recover to some degree. I mean, there's ways to kind of deal with this, but stopping nature with walls seems a little bit like really hard to do.
Yeah, absolutely. There are also negative impacts of building a gigantic wall on the coast for marine wildlife.
Yeah.
And there are also negative impacts for people with nice ocean views.
So I don't understand. Like, if you have a giant wall like that, at some point there'll be nodes, like the waveform will form and it will hit the wall, and then it will radiate in different ways and cause crests and valleys in other areas that it wouldn't normally. Like,
it's not going to be
neutral to the entire area. True. It's going to affect things.
True. Strictly speaking, it'll be a series of walls and it'll be of varying height. So certain areas, it'll be up to 12.5 meters tall, which is
it's huge.
Yeah. That's 12, 24, 36, 37.5 feet ish. 30, 40 feet.
So they'll do fragments of wall, and then basically the idea would be to break up the strong wave into many crazy other waves. I mean, that's the thing, is it's going to still be devastating, I would assume.
Yeah. I mean, it just depends on how you do this, right? Yeah. I don't know. Personally, I just would rather have humans, make peace with the fact that things like this will happen, and take precautionary measures, like not living under sea level in an area where the ocean is.
I think you guys are looking at this all wrong. Hmm. Imagine the great swimming pool they'll have after the storm.
Oh, God.
The giant walls. Hey, we're going to talk about night vision in a minute, and also about a man who, because of facial recognition, came back from the dead.
What?
Listen to Geek Speak here on KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. This is 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm with Ben Jaffe and Brian Young, and we're talking about tech news. Ben, this might be the creepiest story I've heard ever.
Yes.
I'm tempted to skip it.
Have you heard of Science for the Masses?
Generally, no. That was like an organization.
Everything seems fine so far, right?
Yeah, sure.
Seems like a good name for an awesome organization. It's a group of biohackers, which are people who are hacking biology to make the human body do different things. Sounds a little creepy.
This is the kind of people that will cut open their finger and put in a magnetic pellet in a plastic silicone ball, and then sew it back up and their skin heals, and then they can put their hand around electronic wires and feel current and actually feel electricity.
Yeah, and they also eventually start being able to tell north from south.
So they say.
I think there was a study on that, but I'm not sure.
I could do it, yeah.
So anyway, they are trying to enhance human eyesight so you can see in the dark.
Like by wearing goggles?
Not by wearing goggles. Oh, no. That's not biohacking, Lyle. This is by putting this particular mixture in your eyeball.
What kind of mixture? Like a chemical mixture?
It says in the article, it uses a kind of chlorophyll analog called chlorine E6, which is found in some deep sea fish and occasionally is used to treat night blindness. So they moved ahead with that.
So you use an eyedropper like Visine and rip this into your eye?
You know, this is the part that I don't want to research further. There's a terrifying, terrifying picture of them either dropping an eyedropper kind of thing into an eye, or I don't know.
No, if it's worse.
It looks scarier. I'm just going to go with it's
injecting into your eye.
No.
Yeah, they inject the eye and fill it.
So anyway, whatever this is.
Describe the picture. Actually, no, I'll do it. I'll describe it. Go watch Pitch Black with Vin Diesel playing Riddick. His eyes are kind of chromey.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So this is the picture of the person after they had the treatment. Stuff in their eye. Yeah, and basically their pupils look like they're tremendous, huge. It's like their eyes don't have a color. They're just black because their pupils look so dilated.
Like a demon.
Exactly. It looks like a demon person.
I want to know if it's permanent. I really want to know.
It's not. The next day, the guy's fine.
But he could see in the dark?
Yeah. So here's what he said. He said, quote, "To me, it was a quick greenish-black blur across my vision, and then it dissolved into my eyes." And then
injecting. Thank gosh.
And then after about an hour, he starts being able to see in more, darker situations. So they put him in a dark field and they asked them.
You're covering the picture with your hand to read the story.
I'm literally referencing the story for facts while holding my hand over the screen because this guy looks like a demon. It's freaky.
All right, let's move on to something else because you're a freaking man.
I don't know.
Okay, let's move on to something else. Talk about software.
It's hurting his vision.
I don't know.
Close the tab.
Also, the traditional so when you see night vision in movies, right, everything's kind of green.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because they get a monochromatic picture and they tint it green. I don't know why, because it looks
so
cool.
So your eyes probably don't lose your normal night vision.
Well, that would be red. See that?
No, I think green does that too. Your iris will not close with just a light amount of green.
Oh, huh. All right.
I think that's why.
We'll do research and report back.
All right.
I think you're wrong, and you think I'm wrong.
How tempting.
But
well,
anyway.
I know that red is good for low light. I mean, red light is a good experience for your eyes.
That's why you have red flashlights when you're looking at stars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I don't think green is the same way.
Right.
Green is Matrix. And blue
it's
is
probably,
the future.
It's probably night vision was probably traditionally done with a green because the screen had to be green because that's the type of technology we had.
That's,
and then it just kind of took on that nomenclature that green means night vision.
Yeah, that's probably what it is.
Because I've seen night vision now that's black and white.
But as far as I know, it's just that he's just more sensitive to light, and so he can see things in the dark.
All right, software. Ben, can you describe to me what Dart is?
Oh, I was hoping you could describe it.
It's a
JavaScript transpiler.
Okay, what's a transpiler?
So you program in one language, and then the computer automatically transpiles or converts, if you will, into another language. So in this case, you're coding in the language Dart, and then it gets transpiled into JavaScript so it can run in your browser.
Right.
And there are all kinds of potential benefits that you get with languages that transpile into JavaScript in this example. Like, for example, JavaScript, there is no official typing system, right? Yeah. So you could have a variable which is a number or it's a string or it could be whatever.
That can actually be a detriment to programming in JavaScript because because of that, it's harder for a compiler or a runtime compiler to actually enhance the program more effectively.
Yeah, so it can't do optimizations.
That's right.
Because it doesn't necessarily know this is a whole list or an array of all numbers.
But you can use strict and some types of formats for data structures in JavaScript to actually get the runtime to work. This is how ASM works, for example, which you can actually almost run full-time stuff in Mozilla browser. But in any case,
So Dart was
JavaScript. The reason why you want to target JavaScript is that it's the most prolific language on the planet. Computer
every browser uses it. Every mobile phone uses it.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
A bunch of watches probably.
And therefore,
run it.
If you have a language that can compile it and make it run on JavaScript, you can kind of make it run anywhere.
Yeah. So Dart was Google's version.
Yeah. And their general concept was JavaScript's kind of a horrible language, but Dart can be a really awesome language. And so if you write in Dart and we compile it to JavaScript, then everybody wins. And
I would only say JavaScript not being a horrible language, but a non-ideal language.
Now, I personally love JavaScript. It's my
bread and butter.
I love JavaScript in many ways. I think of it, and I probably have had a dream in
I definitely have had dreams in JavaScript.
But you guys also know the pitfalls of JavaScript and know where to stay away.
Absolutely.
True, you have to know it really well.
There's a good book by Douglas Crockford called JavaScript, The Good Parts. And the point he often makes is just don't use the bad parts of any language, right?
So Lars Back and Kasper Lund, both co-founders of the Dart language.
Those are Google guys.
That's Google guys. They've been telling for a long time that basically JavaScript's dead because of Dart. And what's been going on is that the Chrome engine, the V8 engine inside Chrome, which runs JavaScript, it's a JavaScript core inside the Chrome browser, there's been this goal to actually have it run Dart natively. So you could actually have a faster runtime, which means you could actually potentially embed Dart directly in a web page and have the browser. Well, they're stopping that. Dart's basically dead, and it's kind of a surprise to most developers. Their little discussion about it darts around the words quite a bit, but the long and the short of it, they're not going to put it in Chrome anymore, and I think it's going away.
So Dart will bites the dust. So Dart will not be running natively
in V8
in the Chrome JavaScript engine.
So yay JavaScript.
this just raises an interesting point to me, which is that there's so, in particular the front end web development community, but generally the web community as a whole moves so fast. Like people will joke that every week there's a new JavaScript framework, but it's actually true now at this point. There's just a new announcement or a new technology you want to learn.
What are you guys using for the front end right now? Brian?
For the front end?
Yeah. Well, you use iOS development. So,
right. So totally. I'm doing all Swift right now.
Ah, oh, see. Which new language.
Looks a little bit like JavaScript.
Yeah, it does a little bit.
Do you mean frameworks?
Yeah. What about you?
I like Knockout. I like Angular 1 point whatever.
I've been switching over to React lately, and that's the Facebook.
Yeah, platform. I've been playing a little with React too.
Isn't code talk.
But the point I was going to make is that in this world of web development, everything is moving so fast that it raises the question of, as a developer in this climate, how do you choose what to learn and what not to learn? You know, like, if I had made a different choice a couple months ago, I could be really, really invested in Dart.
Yeah.
And it goes away, and all of a sudden...
I would argue, though, as a software engineer, that would probably have been a fine thing to do, because you would have learned stuff by thinking in that other language.
But there are better things to do with one's time.
I don't know.
If it's slow enough moving, I guess the point I'm making is it feels like a lot of the companies that are making these new languages or making these frameworks or whatever, they don't stick around in the same way as other technologies or other languages do. And so it's a unusual space to be in.
I agree. I think it's a very fast-moving space. I think in general, computer technology, the best skill you can have and the one skill everyone should learn is the ability to change what they know.
Yeah, the ability to learn.
The ability to learn. You've got to do that. Like when people decide to stay with what they know and they try to stick into that and dig their feet into the ground and say, oh, I like it this way and this is the way I'm going to be, it just doesn't work in the long term, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yep. And then if they get lucky, they're maintaining legacy systems for 30 years.
Yeah, there's always jobs doing that. Mm-hmm. Hey, I mentioned that someone was brought back from the dead because of computers. Yeah, How'd that happen?
What was about that? What was that?
Yeah, we're starting to have some scary stories on the show. So
zombies.
I can't get that image of the demon person out of my head.
The eyeball injection?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, it might fit here. But so there was a man who had faked his own death and magically reappeared as someone else. So something that's been going on for a while with, what's the word I'm thinking
facial
of?
Facial recognition?
Facial recognition in... our
like federal in airports and such
government,
yes. Yeah.
Passports.
Oh, passports.
Okay, there we go.
Sorry. So they've been doing a beta test in doing facial recognition on passport photos as people apply, and this gentleman faked his own death and then assumed the identity of someone else.
Was he getting a passport?
Yeah. So he just simply submitted for a passport using this false identity, and the Charleston. Passport agency
sure.
Went ahead and ran the photo through, and they realized that the ID came up as somebody else. And when comparing the two people, they realized the original ID, which is the person,
the deceased,
the person that he was trying to assume the identity of, is named Ernest Allen Willis. They found his photo as well, and his skin was African American. He was black. The other gentleman who was trying to assume his identity was white, and they found him. And
well, that's not amazing computer technology to totally, you know, detect facial tones. But I'm assuming it found it because of facial triggers, the triangulation.
Exactly.
Of the eye,
this is an automated process that was alerting them.
And so
he was sure that he was going to get away with this. When they came looking for him, they had absolutely no fear of being
caught.
Was
he wanted for a crime? Is that what he committed?
Yes, he was faking his death for insurance.
Oh, wow.
So he wasn't resurrected. Darn it. I thought technology was resurrecting people. I was just watching a fun show about that.
But that would have been Frankenstein. Yeah. Wow.
Hey, it's World Backup Day, Brian?
It is World Backup Day, starting tomorrow, I believe. So, do you guys back up your data?
I do.
I know you do.
I do.
That's tomorrow, March 31st, or tomorrow, the Sunday?
April 5th.
Yeah, we're recording on a different day, so time gets really weird.
I also jumped a story. We'll get back to that story in just a second. Ben, biometric.
Yeah, back up. Let's talk about this. Okay. Biometric experiments. Yeah, speaking of facial recognition, as it turns out, the customs officers at Washington, D.C.'s Dulles Airport are using facial recognition technology, and probably it's going to be spreading throughout airports across the world. And
resurrecting people as it goes.
Right. So I don't know. This just raises a lot of questions for me, you know, like the idea of using facial recognition more and more widely, right? I already feel pretty blah about about TSA and the whole airport rigmarole and everything.
The security theater.
It's just
Well,
Yeah, go ahead.
It's always a challenge because, of course, law enforcement really always wants these kind of tools, right? It's very helpful to mass surveil and find people out of the haystack. But yeah, it's a little creepy to do this.
Yeah.
What airports are doing this? Like, where is this going on?
This is just Washington, D.C.'s Dulles Airport right now.
Okay, so just the U.S. Customs area for like non-citizens or citizens
just,
too? That's always the question too, because you can do a lot more to non-citizens in the screening of people coming to the country.
I think it's both, but I'll have to double check that. But yeah, I mean, the idea is when you are doing things like recognizing people based on faces or putting them through other identity checks and they're not at all suspected of wrongdoing, it opens up a door for innocent people to be suspected of wrongdoing, right? And it just feels like kind of a there's a lot of potential for abuse of this system.
It also feels like an invasion of privacy when it really comes down to it, right? It feels like people are checking you out in weird ways. Like, normally glance is fine, but if someone were coming in, like looking at your underwear or looking in your wallet, that's an invasion of privacy.
Yeah.
And the idea of mass screening of facial and who you are by mass identification is a little bit like that, a little bit too deep a probe.
Yeah. I mean, we also have technology where cop cars will look at license plates and just kind of watch see if they see any license plates and weird places and all that stuff. So although technically, theoretically, it should be fine, technically you are also being tracked by people that you're not consenting to have track you. So
okay.
I don't know.
So let's give some good advice. Brian, can you help us get some good advice to our to everybody?
So we all hear it. We all the geeks say they do it, but we got to back up our stuff. So but it says here that about 30% of the people out there who have a computer or a phone or some electronic device that has their important photos on it, their important financial records, don't back up their stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like at all.
So yeah, I just feel as a geek, it's our duty to start giving people more of an idea of what they need to be doing.
Yeah.
So how do you guys back up your stuff?
Well, so I use iCloud for my phone. I back it up through iCloud, which means that it's constantly backing up. Recently, my free allotment space ran out. I haven't paid for it. So now I'm manually backing up on my machine, and I do it every other day or so, which means there's a bit of time where I could lose photos. But my photos, which I mostly care about on my phone, are auto-synced to Google and also to Flickr. And ones I care about, I normally post on Facebook and Instagram and all that. So I'm a bit of a you know, spam my content everywhere.
So your photos are theoretically safe in several different places.
My photos are relatively safe, yes.
So if Flickr went down and your computer burst into flames,
I'd still have
and
a
you
Google+.
Put out the fire with that, you know, fire...
The sonic the subwoofer that explodes my screens,
thing, Your photos would still be somewhere.
Now, my camera photos, like the on my SLR, I also do a manual process, and that is a every time I import them, I dupe them. So yeah. I'm pretty good about backup. Ben, what about you?
I am okay about backup. I use Time Machine for my computer, and my last backup was 21 days ago.
That's three weeks. That's gonna be painful.
So I should practice what I preach. But the thing that I would implore our listeners, if you're listening, well, of course, if you're listening, you're hearing me. Back up your stuff if you haven't. If you haven't backed it up at all, your hard drive will fail someday. Maybe someday soon. Yeah. So back up your stuff at least once.
So I just want to one-up you one more. Uh-huh. There's plenty of people that just heard that and still have no idea what we said. So
that's true.
Geeks out there, find a family member, find a friend.
That's wonderful.
And give them a tool to back up with.
That's right. You know, you can buy a little USB external hard drive and attach it to their machine. Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you like. Just let them know we say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 889 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at KOSP.org. To find out more information about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. And of course, you can send us email and participate online with us. We're KOSP Geeks. Of course, we're geeks at geekspeak.org. And our theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell with Ben Jaffe and Brian Young for April 4th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week or online.